looking unsure.
Weird, strange.
Rowan tried to help her out.
Special, she settled on. Why do you always keep your hands in your pockets?
Rowan hesitated, surprised that she had noticed. He'd never been asked to explain himself before to anyone besides his parents, and certainly not to another kid. But Holly was different. Rowan felt an innate trust in her, not to mention she had basically saved his life. His parents had drilled it into his head that he should never talk about his ability. But for the first time, he wanted to confide in someone. He wanted a friend. So he told her, more than he had ever told anyone. And the worst day of Rowan's young life suddenly turned out to be the best. They sat on the grass, eating caramel corn and talking as the marching bands went past, their horns blaring a glorious New Orleans hello. The trumpets and tubas created a wall of sound that pushed through the parade line. From afar, Rowan watched the St. Augustine band play a synchronized masterpiece. The musicians wore white gloves and looked invincible in their uniforms as they marched. Rowan thought, maybe gloves are what I need. Holly listened to every word he said without interruption. She didn't appear to be shocked by his secret. In fact, she asked Rowan if he could come to her house the next day and tell her some of the stories behind her favorite antiques. He said sure. When Rowan came back to Orleans Street with a bloody nose and a black eye, his parents had a meltdown, and they threatened to pull him from school altogether. But Rowan insisted he could handle the bullies. And he did. With Holly's friendship, no one dared to taunt or tease him. Because of Holly Beauchene, Rowan had been given a free pass, allowing him to get through school unscathed. Holly became his best friend and the keeper of his secret, and Rowan kept those Mardi Gras beads as a reminder of that fateful day, and of how sometimes a guardian angel came in the guise of a friend. Mellicent let go of the beads. Never had she experienced a memory so vivid, so powerful before. For a split moment, she had been with Rowan and Holly on the grass, her heart heavy and uplifted all at once. She'd peered into the recesses of a beautiful friendship and witnessed its beginnings. Mellicent had seen the real Holly behind the outer face she presented to the world. Mellicent didn't know the rest of their story, but she didn't need to. All of her insecurity and questions about Holly had been erased by one memory. Mellicent loved that little girl who had taken on Billy Crump and shielded Rowan from everyone else. Holly had seen his gift, recognized his fragility, and become his protector. No wonder Holly had taken Robert West's place at the helm of West Inc. after he died. No one else could.
33. The Clock Tower. Rowan had given Holly an all but impossible assignment: get him and Sun inside the crystal cave. The problem was, the cave was located 1,000 feet below the Earth's surface and was not open to the public. Cueva de los Cristales was controlled by Peñoles Mining Company, along with their Naica mine operation. The Naica mines had been in business since 1910. And had Mexico's most productive mining for lead and silver. The company kept the crystal cave separate from the mine, and the area was restricted to a team of scientists. Holly had been keeping him apprised all day. After several strategic calls, starting with the head of the National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, who they had worked with on the return of a Mayan sculpture, she had managed to get the head of Peñoles on the phone. Rowan answered his cell right away when he saw it was her. How did it go?
It's going to cost you.
How much?
For $1 million, you can have a private tour, no questions asked.
Good, Rowan said without hesitation. Wire the money.
Good? Have you lost your mind? What on earth is down there that's worth $1 million? It's not like you can bring anything back.
For Rowan, reaching the cave transcended any dollar amount. Every antique he'd ever found, every treasure he'd unearthed and sold, was enabling him to make this journey.
It's going to lead me to answers about Stuart, about me, our ability, everything. There's no price tag for that.
Holly was silent for a moment. Then she said,
I'll text you when it's done and give you a contact at the site.
Thank you, really. He couldn't have done this without her.
Thank me by getting to the bottom of all this with Stuart.
The stress was evident in her voice.
Where are you right now?
Stuck in the back of a cab on my way to the airport. He'd used that time to research more on Nika. The city of Chihuahua was the closest place to fly into. He called his charter company and booked a Gulfstream with a private bedroom to fly him direct. Flying from Bengaluru to Chihuahua on the fastest jet with a king-size bed had also cost a small fortune, but he desperately needed uninterrupted sleep. At this point, he was so exhausted he was slurring his words, and he needed all his strength for whatever awaited him in Mexico. When Sun had insisted on meeting him there, Rowan hadn't said no. He might need her help. He'd never touched ancient crystals before. By design, crystals were powerful mediums of nature, the integral force behind watches and computers, making the modern world sing. They also held the most precise imprints, second to flowers, like a pure recording. But unlike flowers, which died within days or weeks, crystals remained for millennia. Rowan wasn't sure what would happen when he touched a crystal that held imprints spanning 500,000 years. He wasn't sure he could survive it. All he knew was that the Uphart's labyrinth led to the crystal cave, and Melisandre would never be safe until he found out why. He emailed Sun the name of the motel where they would meet in Saucillo, which was a small town south of Chihuahua, close to the mine. Rowan had been the one in charge of getting them into the cave, and Holly had not let him down. Before Holly hung up, she surprised him by saying,
I think you should call Melisandre.
Rowan didn't say anything at first.
How is she?
Upset, from what I can tell, though she's trying to hide it. I would be too. Not the smoothest move running off like that. Don't pull a Gianna on her.
He could feel Holly shaking her head at him. She had helped him weather all of his previous failed relationships. Believe me, I'm not. His feelings for Melisandre were totally different from anyone in the past. But he couldn't reveal that he'd left Melisandre because the trip was too dangerous, or Holly never would have helped him. I'll be back soon and work everything out. He was almost to the airport when his phone rang again. He didn't recognize the number and answered, thinking it was his contact for the cave. Stuart's voice was the last thing he expected to hear.
Stuart? Where are you? Listen, I can't talk right now. Stuart cut him off, out of breath. I just managed to get free. Can you make it to our meeting place? I'll explain everything there. Can you meet me tomorrow? Stuart, wait. I read the flowers. I've got your computer and the map. Are you hurt?
Oh my God, thank you, he said, his voice weak. Thank you.
Who took you? Is Gian with you?
I'm alone. I don't know who they are. Stuart broke down, becoming emotional. They had me in an abandoned warehouse at the Isle of Dogs. They got a phone call and left and never came back. I was able to escape.
Where are you now?
I'm still in London.
Can you get to Mexico by tomorrow?
Mexico?
The Uparts lead to Nika, Mexico. We found the answer.
After the wire was sent, Holly texted Rowan telling him how to get in touch with the operations manager of the cave, Oscar Gonzalez. When Rowan called the man, Oscar had no idea who Rowan was or how he'd obtained permission to get inside the cave. All Oscar had been told was to provide the tour and to be discreet. Rowan and Sun would meet him at the mine tomorrow afternoon after all the scientists had left for the day.
Are you both in good health? Oscar asked over the phone.
His voice was gravelly, and his English was laced with a thick Mexican accent.
It's going to be three of us, Rowan corrected him. My brother will be there too.
Is he in good health? It's hot as hell down there. Even with a special life support suit and gear, you can only remain in the cave for 40 minutes. Without it, 15 minutes or you're dead. Comprende? So your tour will be short.
Rowan had read about the challenges the cave's explorers had faced. Not only was the Crystal Cave 1,000 feet underground, it was situated on an ancient fault line directly above a magma pool. Because of its location, the temperature stayed at a steady 120 degrees with 90% humidity. Those conditions had created the perfect environment for the world's largest crystals to grow, with one towering more than 40 feet tall and weighing 55 tons. The giant crystal cave resembled a real-life fortress of solitude, even more magnificent than anything imagined for Superman. The cavern had gained the attention of biologists, geologists, crystallographers, cave scientists, and space exploration experts from around the world. They came to Nika to see what secrets the crystals could reveal about ancient life on Earth and its relationship to the universe. But none of them was a psychometrist. Rowan was about to collect a whole other set of data. Rowan slept the entire flight, suspended above the clouds and oblivious to the turbulence as the plane arched across the globe at 800 miles per hour. He awoke shortly before landing in Mexico and performed the same series of deep stretches he always did before climbing. Nervous energy trilled through him at the thought of the journey he was about to make. He ended the session with a powerful Bhairava mudra, the mudra of fierce determination. When he stepped off the plane in Mexico, he could have been anywhere, in any time zone. The world had begun to feel that small. There was no meter in the taxi to Saucillo. The old man driving him negotiated in advance the fare for the hour-and-a-half ride south through the desert. The rusted Toyota Corolla blared mariachi music from the speakers the entire way, in a rich symphony of horns, strings, and a chorus of men that filled the car and spilled out through the open windows. Rowan closed his eyes, feeling the December sun on his face and the whip of the desert wind as the car raced down Highway 45 through northern Mexico. The long stretches of farms passed by him like a stream. They drove through the city of Delicias and soon after reached Saucillo, a town of 11,000. Rowan was meeting Sun at a motel near the town center. They would see Stuart tomorrow at the site if he could get there in time. Rowan had emailed him the UPART map, showing him just how they'd arrived at their destination. On the way to the motel, the taxi drove past the town square, where a charming clock tower stood, and Rowan smiled. It was either the perfect welcome or an ominous sign. Hanush had died in the clock tower, and Rowan had the man's key in his bag next to Descartes' ring. Rowan thanked the driver and got out of the car, grabbing his duffel. The motel he was staying in was a three-story red brick building with bars on the windows. The restaurant next door had a hand-painted welcome sign with a cow on it, saying flautas and tortas. The people of Saucillo were eyeing him as he walked to the motel. They seemed to wonder what the tall stranger wearing gloves and all black was doing there. When Rowan checked in, he found that Sun had already arrived. He went upstairs to drop off his things before meeting her. His Spartan motel room had a white tile floor, a double bed, a scuffed-up old dresser, and a loud mini-fridge. That was it, but at least everything was spotlessly clean. He had several messages from his mother's home number on his phone. She must have realized he'd gone off the radar. Like Mellicent's voicemails, he ignored them. Talking to either of them right now would make him second-guess his decision to be there altogether. He couldn't allow his emotions and attachments to make him change course. He had less than 24 hours until he was in the cave. All his life, Rowan had felt like an astronaut, out of place in the world as he launched into the inner depths of the past. Tomorrow would be his hardest journey, but a journey he had to make. Whatever he discovered in that cave would be the collateral they could use against whoever was targeting them. Rowan didn't know what answers he would find tomorrow. But as he'd come to understand since the age of 5, when he'd first held Leonard Sly's guitar and seen the man's life, anything was possible.
34. The kimono. Is there any chance I have your ability too? Oh, 'cause that'd be seriously awesome. Parker called out from the breakfast room. He was sitting at the table, reading something from the internet on his phone.
This article says technically everybody has it, because we're all electromagnetic transmitters and receivers or whatever, but some people's brains are hardwired to be better at it. Like yours. Which, to me, is mind-blowing because, well, you're you. Haha, very funny.
Millicent rolled her eyes. She put a bottle of sparkling water on the table and went back to the kitchen.
Ooh, this is creepy, Parker read. Since the brain doesn't immediately die with the heart, a psychometrist could attempt neuro-residual recollection and read a dead person's last thoughts.
Very creepy. I won't be doing that, she said from the kitchen.
How about tactile telepathy? He called out. Reading people's thoughts in general by holding their hand. Can you do that?
Millicent returned with two dinner plates without answering. She and Rowan had done it once with each other, but she wasn't about to share that with her brother. Can we eat and save the 20 questions for later? She had heated up one of the many frozen pizzas Parker had bought when he and Holly went to the store. It seemed surreal that they were basically homeless and had taken over Rowan's house when he wasn't even there. She glanced at Parker. Maybe this would be a good time to discuss something with him that had been on her mind. Listen, I want to talk to you about the house. What if we donate the land to the city and build a park in Mom's memory? She'd been trying to figure out what to do with the property. The arson investigator had notified her the case was officially cold, and the house was being released back to her. They'd sent her the fire report, and she had pulled up the pictures online. She didn't want to show them to Parker. It was best if he didn't see the aftermath. There wasn't enough of the house to restore, and she wouldn't have wanted to rebuild it even if there was. Not after the memory of the fire and the man who had set it. That night would forever haunt her, even more so if she returned. But she also didn't want to discard all the beautiful years they had had growing up. The house had been Sadie's childhood home, too. Millicent wanted children to climb their trees again. And what better way than to clear out what was left of the house's frame, lay down new grass, and build a playground? The corner lot was the perfect location for a neighborhood park. We could name it Sadie Park. Parker's eyes were bright when she finished outlining the plan, and he agreed. Her heart lifted, knowing that he thought it was a good idea.
Maybe we should move here to New Orleans, Parker said. It's not like anything's keeping us in LA anymore. I can finish school here.
It was a good sign that he was thinking of school again. Right now, he was officially on family leave because of the fire, but he'd have to go back after the holiday break. New Orleans could be a fresh start for both of them. She mulled the idea. What would I do for work here?
Don't you have like $2 million?
Millicent laughed. You keep saying that, but I still want a career.
Become an antique hunter like Rowan. Have you seen all the stuff in the warehouse? It's insane.
She had to admit that returning lost heirlooms sounded like a fascinating job. Maybe she could work with Rowan. For the foundation. She hadn't been back in the warehouse yet, and after dinner, Parker talked her into going on a tour. When they flipped the switch, the lights turned on like the sun, illuminating the space, and her mouth dropped open. Rowan's world stretched out before her, filled with the thousands of stories he'd collected.
He's like Indiana Jones turned hoarder.
Parker's voice carried across the warehouse as he headed toward the back.
Check out all these candelabras! It's so goth! Don't touch anything, she called out to him.
Millicent wasn't an appraiser, but she could see that many of these pieces could grace a museum. The storefront on Magazine contained only a fraction of what Rowan owned. The warehouse was filled with racks of paintings, ancient maps, temple doors, furniture and chandeliers, figurines and iconography from around the world, all organized by some sort of system Millicent couldn't decipher. She wandered through the rows, her arms crossed with her hands tucked under them. It wasn't that she was afraid to touch anything, she told herself. There was simply too much to choose from. Along the back wall were built-out offices and individual storage rooms. When Mellicent opened the first door and stepped inside, she was greeted with the same hollow feeling she'd had in the back room of the magazine storefront. She almost closed the door and left the room alone, but instead she forced herself to walk inside and turn on the light. When the lights came on, she gasped with pleasure. The room was filled with Japanese kimonos displayed on oversized hangers that stretched out the arms to showcase the graceful T-shaped sleeves. Each gown had a matching obi and was made of heavy silk in vivid hues of red or gold. Cascading images of cranes, flowers, or cherry blossoms trailed over the fabric in delicate patterns. Many kimonos were paired with a tansu, a wooden wardrobe chest, or kyodai, which was a dainty mirrored vanity with an array of tiny drawers and cabinets. Some of the sets had all three pieces. The whole room felt like an exhibit at a museum. From the lot numbers and the pages of notes next to each, she knew right away that she had found another collection for the Heirloom Foundation. Like the Lakota collection, these antiques weren't for sale. Rowan was planning to return them. The first kimono was a dramatic black and white silk with red poppies brocaded at the hem and shoulders. When Mellicent touched the gown, she was greeted by memories of loss so strong they felt like rain. A woman named Emi Tanaka had been the last person to own this kimono, and the tears were hers. Emi was an American whose grandparents were Issei, first-generation Japanese who had come to California from Japan and settled years ago. Emi didn't speak Japanese, but she treasured her grandmother's tansu, kyodai, and kimono. Emi had planned to give her bridal set, called a bride's yomeire do-ogu in Japanese, to her daughter, Mary, one day. Emmy's plans for the future ended with Pearl Harbor. The day after the attack, her family's bank account was frozen. Hysteria gripped the nation over anyone who looked Japanese. Within 2 months, the government issued instructions to Emmy and her family informing them that they would be relocated to a military camp, somewhere. They would have to leave all their belongings, their pets, their cars, and first go to the Santa Anita racetrack in Los Angeles, which was the closest temporary detention center. Rumors of barbed wire and armed guards were already flying. Emmy couldn't imagine what it would be like. They said that people were sleeping in horse stalls. She didn't know how long they would have to stay at the racetrack before they would be shipped to a camp. They were being constructed in California, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and Arkansas. 10 camps to hold the entire Japanese-American population, 120,000 people. No one was given word if and when they could ever return home again. The week before Emmy received her relocation orders, her husband was taken in for questioning. The FBI came and knocked on their door and took him away without warning. All the family knew was he was to be sent to a different camp, a special camp, for interrogation. Emmy's husband was a school teacher and also wrote for the local newspaper. The U.S. government was rounding up all the Japanese-American professors, journalists, and community leaders to ensure that they weren't spies. Emmy packed the one suitcase she was allowed to bring while her daughter watched. Mary was only 3. Emmy opened each drawer of her tansu and looked at all of the things she couldn't take with her. She laid her kimono on the bed. The poppies spread across the blanket like a field of flowers, and she let her daughter's hands touch the gown for the first and last time. Then Emmy carefully hung it back up in the closet. The story within the kimono ended there when Emmy dimmed the lights of her bedroom, took her daughter's hand, and left with their one suitcase. They both were dressed in their Sunday best. Emmy's parents and in-laws would all leave together, walking out of their homes and into a new, dark world without hope. Emmy never returned or touched her things again. Mellicent lifted her hand from the gown, her heart heavy. She read through the notes Rowan had made for Emmy's tansu, kyodai, and kimono. Rowan had found Emmy's treasures, and he'd charted the imprints, enabling him to track down her descendants. Emmy, along with her entire family, had been imprisoned in Manzanar, a camp located at the foot of the Sierra Nevada in California, until November 1945. After 4 years in captivity, they were released. They had no home, no money, no place to go. Their property had been taken, all their possessions gone. Emmy's daughter Mary was now 81, a retired nurse who lived in San Francisco. She had one daughter and three grandchildren. Emmy had died 15 years ago. Melisande walked through the room, the kimonos watching her like silent women. Their voices were woven into the silk. She read every page of Rowan's notes for every Yomeire Dogu. He had worked hard to find the women who were the rightful owners of these heirlooms, and he was attempting to rebuild the bridges between mothers and daughters, grandmothers and granddaughters that had been destroyed by the war. Melisande finally understood Rowan's mission for the Heirloom Foundation. Rowan was trying to help mend the wounds he encountered throughout history. The forgotten wounds. The buried wounds. Rowan wasn't a collector. He was a healer. There were more rooms, like this one, sequestered in the warehouse, filled with the dark stones of the past Rowan had overturned. When she was strong enough, she would visit them all. Now that she was trying to connect with her ability, she was touching life for the first time, looking under its skin and seeing all its facets, shadows, and light. She wiped tears from her face that she hadn't felt fall and left, shutting the door. Her heart ached too much to stay. Right now, she only wanted to be with the man who had built this room and found these treasures. Where was he? Was he safe? The questions wouldn't leave her mind. She had left Rowan so many messages, but she knew he wasn't going to call her back. He had continued on the journey without her. He may have taken his gloves off with her for one night, but in his heart, he had put them back on.
35. The coin. Rowan came out of the shower to discover his phone, laptop, and wallet had been stolen. His duffel bag had been rifled through, but nothing else was taken. St. Gaudens's model coin was still in his pant pocket, and the ooparts were in the secret pouch in his travel bag. The irony didn't escape him. The thief had missed not one, but three priceless items, and taken everything that was expendable. Rowan put his hand on the room's doorknob and could see the thief clearly. A 12-year-old boy, a local, who had been tipped off by his uncle that a wealthy tourist was staying there. They had instructed him to get his wallet, cell phone, wristwatch, and whatever else he could find that looked valuable. The boy had squatted outside, waiting for the sound of the shower, and picked the lock with ease. His father and uncle ran a chop shop outside of Saucillo that brought in stolen cars within a 300-mile radius. They were experts at breaking into anything. Rowan sat down on the bed and rubbed his eyes. So much for locking the door. It was going to be a hassle to replace his passport and get money wired, but he'd deal with that headache after the cave. Right now, a stolen ID seemed inconsequential, and no one could access the information in his phone but him. At least he wouldn't be tempted to call Melisande and hear her voice. He also wouldn't continue to feel guilt while watching the number of voicemails from his mother rack up. Neither of them would approve of what he was doing. His father might. Was that why he was pushing himself so hard now? To find out if his father was right? Had his gift been worth the demise of their family? Tomorrow he hoped to find out. He changed and met Sun downstairs in the courtyard. She looked just as she had in New York in her tunic jacket and pants. Rowan felt a wellspring of emotions when he saw her. If Sun hadn't given him her fan, she would have remained a stranger. He might have even suspected she was behind the psychometrist's disappearances. But Sun inherently understood how vital it was they trust each other, and she had foreseen the best way to do that. How different his world might have been if a psychometrist like Sun had been his teacher. He'd lived his whole life closed off from people, even from his parents, if he was honest. But Sun had opened a door and pushed her way in. "Shall we walk?" she asked him. She took off without waiting for an answer, just like she had on their first meeting in New York, and the moment began to take on a dreamlike quality. Rowan might be a 4.5-hour flight from New Orleans, but today was the farthest he'd ever been from home. And tomorrow would be the equivalent of sailing off the edge of the world. He and Sun made their way toward the town square right as dusk finished its fall. Near the church, a dance rehearsal was underway. A dozen couples were spinning and weaving in complex patterns, while onlookers clapped, and a little girl in fairy wings ran around them. The sleepy town was an assortment of old pickup trucks, men with cowboy hats, and colorful buildings nestled between the hills. Rowan and Sun passed a flamenco studio and a bright purple painted restaurant on the corner. Rowan brought Sun up to speed on his conversation with Stuart, who was en route and meeting them tomorrow afternoon at the site. He'd been able to book a flight to Chihuahua in time.
"Does he know who is behind this?" Sun asked.
Her arms were crossed, and she had a worried frown on her face. "He doesn't. They were keeping him in a warehouse off the docks on the Isle of Dogs. He managed to get away when the guards left."
"Or they let him get away?"
The same thought had crossed Rowan's mind. He studied Sun's closed expression, her face unreadable. And yet, after holding her fan, Rowan could read her expression better than anyone. She was gravely concerned. "I'm sorry about the fire," Rowan offered. They had yet to speak of it. "Have they discovered anything?" Sun waved her hand with a dismissive air, not wanting to discuss it. When they reached the gazebo in the square, Rowan knew it was time to give the fan back. He took the box out of his pocket. Her eyes flashed in response. "Thank you." Rowan tried to convey the depth of his feelings, his voice solemn. "I'm honored you entrusted this in my care." Sun took the box with a nod, and it disappeared within the voluminous folds of her jacket. A guarded look remained in her eyes, an unspoken question. He had not given her anything yet in return. Her absolute trust in him was not guaranteed, and he needed it if he was going into a cave of ancient crystals with 2 uparts in hand. Rowan had brought his coin with him for that purpose. Handing it to her was in essence handing her a book of his life. He never thought he'd share his lucky coin with anyone, and now he was about to give it to a 78-year-old psychometrist in the middle of a desert in Mexico. Life never ceased to amaze him. Sun took St. Gaudens's model coin in her hand and gazed at it, her eyes turning inward. Rowan looked up at the stars beginning to blanket the sky and waited patiently for her to read the imprints. His eyes landed on a nearby lamppost. It was a striking design, with 2 sculptured lions on top, each holding a light and facing away from each other. The pair of lions made him wonder what Melisent was doing right now, what she was feeling after his desertion, what she had found of his to touch. He missed her. He'd made the wrong decision by leaving her behind. He'd shut her out, just as he did to everyone who got too close, no matter how noble his intentions. And he made a vow that no matter what happened tomorrow, he would come back to her. Sun shifted and opened her eyes, finished with the coin. She handed it back to him and folded her hands over his gloved ones. Sun now knew intimate details about him, the thoughts and feelings he had carried in his pocket for so many years. But strangely enough, he didn't mind. He felt free.
"Your greatest fear is time," she said, with startling precision. "The immensity of it, its vastness, its weight. Time has given us our power, and yet time stopped your heart."
Rowan found himself holding his breath as he listened to her go on.
"The earth is billions of years old, and our lives are less than a century.
Every new century is built on the ruins of the old, adding to the weight of our collective memory, like gravity. What will the memory of your life be? What will be its weight?
Her eyes brimmed with understanding.
Cosmic time is something we all search to understand. In ancient Korean philosophy, we believe in the cosmic year. 1 year of the universe is 129,600 years on Earth. 1 month of the universe is 10,800. Our recorded history is less than a week, and our own story begins in the final seconds. This whole life is but a blink in cosmic time. We all want to feel like there is a reason behind the time we live in. Our ability makes us more aware. It's why we're here.
She motioned to the desert.
Why we followed Stuart and Miguel on this journey. The Uparts are speaking to all of us.
Rowan took the coin back and put it in his pocket.
Why aren't you ever afraid of what you might see? He asked.
She measured her words.
Because I cannot pick and choose what to see, just as I cannot choose the time I lived in. So I must see it all.
Rowan knew she was talking about her childhood, the war, and the deaths of her family. Sun stared into his eyes with certainty.
But if there's one thing my life has shown me, there is a place beyond the world that pain and darkness cannot reach. After you experience that place, you can touch anything.
36. The laptop. The sound of the phone, ringing in one of the warehouse's offices, was incessant. It wouldn't stop. After 4 rings and a delay for voicemail, it started up again.
"Should we get that?" Parker yelled to Mellicent from the opposite side of the warehouse. "I don't know."
Mellicent shut the door to another room filled with heirlooms she had been investigating and followed the sound. When she turned on the lights to the office, the ringing stopped. She went inside, sure the caller would try again. A brilliant ruby Persian rug covered most of the floor, and a smaller circular rug in the back corner looked like a meditation mat. Mellicent walked over to the desk made of contemporary chrome and glass and saw Stuart's laptop. She'd found Rowan's office. When the phone rang again, she picked it up abruptly.
Hello?
Hello?
Who is this?
Mellicent recognized Jocelyn's voice right away and cringed. Dr. Mathis. Jocelyn, I'm so sorry. You surprised me. It's Mellicent.
Why are you answering Rowan's office line? Is everything all right?
She sounded frantic.
I've been trying to reach him all day.
Rowan's not here, Mellicent hedged.
But is he all right?
What do you mean? Mellicent was getting alarmed by Jocelyn's tone.
I couldn't sleep last night worrying he might do something foolish again to find Stuart. He had an incident before where he touched something he shouldn't have.
What do you mean he touched something he shouldn't have? Mellicent asked, all the while thinking, he has done something foolish. He'd gone off without her.
Rowan had a heart attack, Jocelyn said flatly.
Mellicent's breath caught as Jocelyn went on to explain what had happened at Göbekli Tepe, how Rowan believed it was the age of the stone that had triggered it.
He told me about Göbekli Tepe, Mellicent said. But not that he almost died.
I'm sure he'll be livid for my telling you.
Do you know where he's gone? Why he's so unreachable?
Mellicent tried to focus on answering Jocelyn's string of questions, still reeling from the revelation of what had happened in Turkey.
Rowan's gone off to find Stuart. I don't know where he is, and he isn't returning my calls either.
The words began to bubble out of her. Mellicent didn't question the impulse to tell Jocelyn everything, starting with the Breguet watch and antiques roadshow. She wanted Jocelyn to know the whole story. By the time Mellicent had gotten to the YouTube fiasco, Jocelyn couldn't have sounded more shocked.
You mean you have the same ability?
Not as strong as Rowan, but yes. Mellicent could hear the wheels turning in Jocelyn's mind.
I see, was all she said.
Mellicent's voice held a slight tremor when she recounted the fire and the imprint of the man who had set it. She explained how Rowan had helped them, and then they had come to London. Rowan had picked up another ominous imprint in Stuart's house. After that, Mellicent knew he'd started keeping things from her.
A psychometrist in New York had her home set on fire, too. It was the fire in Manhattan on the news. I don't know if she's okay.
My God. I can't believe he kept me in the dark about all this. Mellicent felt a twinge of guilt that she had gone against Rowan's wishes and told Jocelyn everything. But damn it, he'd gone against hers, too. Where was he?
Do you think he went to New York?
Jocelyn asked.
To see if this other psychometrist is all right?
Maybe Holly knows. It had been the one question Mellicent had been loath to ask. Even though she no longer harbored the same insecurities she had had when it came to Rowan's childhood friend, it would still hurt if Rowan had confided in Holly and said nothing to her. Mellicent was planning to pin Holly down for more information in the morning, but now it couldn't wait. Jocelyn thought so too.
That's it. I'm flying over there, Jocelyn said. I'll book an early flight this morning and be there by tomorrow.
London was 6 hours ahead, so although it was 8 p.m. in New Orleans, it was 2 a.m. in England. Mellicent hung up and sat down in Rowan's chair, feeling as galvanized as Jocelyn. If Rowan thought he could exclude them and go off by himself to save the damn day, then he had another thing coming. She wasn't going to sit there and wait, either. She picked up the phone and called Holly, who answered on the first ring.
Rowan, what are you doing back? The tour's not until tomorrow.
Mellicent hesitated. Well, she had just gotten her answer. Holly knew exactly where Rowan had gone. It stung, but not as much as she thought it would.
Holly, it's Mellicent.
Oh. Holly sounded flustered.
What are you doing in Rowan's office?
The phone kept ringing, so I answered it. It was Jocelyn trying to reach Rowan. Mellicent could sense Holly's unspoken question. Why were you in the warehouse? But Holly didn't say anything.
Here's the deal.
Mellicent found herself adopting Holly's no-nonsense style.
Jocelyn is worried that Rowan's going to have another incident like Turkey, she said, showing Holly she knew more about Rowan than Holly thought. He's not returning either of our calls. I'm seriously worried, too. Where is he?
Holly became flustered.
Look, Rowan is on a trip investigating something for Stuart, and he'll be back. I'm sorry he hasn't called you yet. If it means anything, I did tell him to.
Mellicent was surprised to hear that, and used it to press her point.
Can you at least tell me where he's gone? Please. Jocelyn is getting on a plane right now, she's so frantic.
Well, dadgummit, Holly muttered, sounding more southern than ever.
I'm pretty sure you know Jocelyn well enough that you're going to have to tell her where he is.
Holly sighed. He's in Nica, Mexico, at the Crystal Cave. I have no idea why. You know Rowan, he's so secretive. But it's got the oldest or the biggest crystals in the world. I had to pull serious strings to get him inside. He said it would help him find Stuart and the answer to everything, whatever that means. At Holly's words, Mellicent sat there frozen, unable to move. She knew what Rowan was planning to do. Her eyes watered and a feeling of helplessness filled her. Rowan had discovered something within the Upart map that led to the cave, and then he'd kept it from her. He was going to risk his life to find out what happened to Stuart and why someone had tried to kill her. It's why he had written her that note, why he had given her the brigade. He didn't know if he was coming back. Holly was busy saying how Rowan would be back soon.
Holly,
Mellicent stopped her cold with her voice.
Don't you see? It's why he won't talk to me or Jocelyn. He's going to try and touch the crystals and read the imprint.
By 2 a.m., Mellicent couldn't sleep. She was too filled with anxiety. After their phone call earlier, Holly had been keeping her abreast. Holly couldn't reach Rowan either, which wasn't a good sign. She was making arrangements to get them to Nika as quickly as possible the next day. Jocelyn was in the air and would land in New Orleans before noon. By morning, Millicent crawled out of bed to get ready. Parker was still asleep. He had talked her into letting him come with them, and she'd agreed. She understood how it felt to be left behind. She went downstairs and made coffee. The inviting aroma helped her wake up. She took a cup to the computer room behind the kitchen and sat down at Rowan's computer to research the Crystal Cave. When she clicked on the pictures that came up, the images of monstrous selenite pillars boggled her mind. That was where they were going? The more she read, the more she wondered how Holly had gotten Rowan inside the cave. The Crystal Cave was off-limits to the public, and even to the miners from Peñoles. The entrance was locked away behind a great steel door, and anyone who went inside needed to wear a special suit packed with ice. Even with the ice suit, humans couldn't survive the heat or the 90% humidity for long. The dangerous conditions were almost the equivalent of going to the moon. Millicent heard Holly's car pulling into one of the cargo bays and went to the warehouse to meet her. Holly gave her a brisk greeting and headed into Rowan's office. I left word with Rowan's contact at the cave for him to call right away when he arrives for his tour this afternoon. I stressed it was urgent. Her cell phone rang. Millicent sat down in Rowan's chair, watching Holly pace as she talked. Jocelyn was due to arrive in 2 hours, and they'd be rendezvousing at the airport to fly by charter direct to Nika. From what she could gather, Holly was on the phone with the head of Peñoles, talking him into letting them use his private airstrip. Holly had painted their arrival as a simple late addition to the tour, a flighty mistake on her part in her efforts to coordinate the group, and she cajoled him into not only letting them use the private airstrip next to the mine's entrance, but into having a representative ready on the ground to escort them to the cave, where they would join Rowan and Son's tour before it began. The goodwill that accompanied a $1 million purchase went quite far. Millicent turned to Stewart's laptop sitting out on Rowan's desk. She wanted to find where Nika fell on the Upart map. When she opened it, the screen immediately powered up. Using the touchpad, she scrolled through the files to find the map. As her hands rested on the keyboard, an ominous feeling began to circle her wrist and coil up her arm like a snake. Her throat constricted, and her heart sped as a whirlwind of imprints entered her mind. This can't be true. She couldn't take her hands off the computer. The thoughts and images were coming hard and fast at her, each one like a physical blow. Stewart had intentionally planted his computer in the safe for them to find. There was a spyware program on it to track the laptop and view its activity from a remote location. Stewart had been using the tracking app to monitor Rowan and know where he was at all times. He'd also planned to steal Jocelyn's cell phone and use her tracking app, too, knowing Jocelyn and Rowan had their phones linked. Rowan hadn't touched this laptop without his gloves on, or he would have felt the same calculating intention. The thoughts from the keyboard continued to bombard her. Suddenly, everything in the world seemed upside down. The man they had been trying to save was at the heart of the darkness. She took her hands off the keys with a cry. Holly hung up the phone. What is it? What happened? Millicent looked at Holly. Her whole body sickened. It's him! It's him! She could only keep repeating. He's the one! Who? Holly stared at the laptop in confusion, trying to catch up. Whose computer is that? Stewart's. Millicent tried to voice what she had felt, what she had seen, but she couldn't. She had just met the man who set her house on fire. He's behind all of it. Millicent had seen Stewart's face clearly for the first time, and she recognized him. The man in the imprints was the man in her nightmares. What are you talking about? Holly had become frozen. The words tumbled from her in a panic. Stewart's after Rowan. He lured Rowan with the disappearances, the threats. They were all to get him to decipher the Uparts. He needed Rowan to figure out the connection because no one else could. You're saying it's all Stewart? Yes. Melisande could barely get the word out.
Everything was planned.
She shook her head, her mind in a fog, unable to believe it. She had seen the moment Stuart locked the laptop in the safe. He'd created a show to fool Rowan, and he'd calculated the outcome. He staged his own kidnapping so Rowan would save him. He put flowers everywhere to record the violence. Holly put her hand over her mouth.
But that's insane.
Melisande nodded. It was beyond insane. The man had hired thugs to beat him up.
But it worked. Rowan's doing exactly what he wants.
Melisande's emotions were clouding her ability to see further than that. She needed to touch the laptop again to try and sense more details, but she wasn't sure she could stomach ever touching it again.
Rowan needs to touch this. He needs to see.
Holly nodded, shell-shocked. We'll bring it with us. It was much harder to break the news to Jocelyn. Jocelyn couldn't believe Stuart would commit such atrocities. She had been the one to introduce Rowan to Stuart and encourage their friendship.
Why would he do such a thing?
Jocelyn thought Melisande was somehow wrong.
It's just not possible. You have to be mistaken.
Melisande, Parker, Holly, and Jocelyn were on the plane en route to Nika. Parker was sitting beside Melisande and surprised her when he reached out and gave her hand a squeeze in reassurance. The love and care in his touch wedged a knot in her throat, and she squeezed back. Jocelyn asked her for the 100th time from across the aisle.
Are you sure you couldn't be confused?
Melisande was trying hard to keep her patience with Rowan's mother. If Stuart was so incapable of doing harm as Jocelyn believed, then somewhere along the way he'd become capable. Melisande was grateful that Holly didn't question her judgment or seem to doubt her. But then Holly had worked with Rowan every day for years. She knew the power of an imprint and the information it could impart. Melisande looked out the plane's window at the clouds. The imprints from Stuart's laptop were still swimming in her mind. She had seen glimpses of him in Jordan where he had found his first Upart. He'd begun to believe there might be a way to travel through time, to not only witness the past, but to actually go back to the moment. He began to study every theory he could on time travel. Wormholes, cosmic strings, time gates and ladders. Stuart was trying not only to read time, but to bend it. He'd become demented in his obsession. She thought back to the moment she had stood in his bedroom, how disturbed she was by what she had seen. This man had taken everything away from her, and now he might take Rowan too. The thought was too much to bear. Holly made a call to the ground.
Thank you so much. We're due to land any minute.
She grew still.
I see. Then we'll join them shortly.
Holly hung up, and any semblance of a smile left her face.
They're already there.
Jocelyn put her hand over her mouth, becoming more upset.
He won't touch the crystals. He knows he can't survive it.
She was talking more to herself, her voice far away. Melisande knew Jocelyn was reliving memories of Turkey. Melisande had already noted with surprise that Jocelyn had her old wedding ring on and was twisting the ring back and forth on her finger. After touching the picture frame, Melisande had been privy to the solemn pact Jocelyn and Robert had made with each other. Their marriage might have ended, but they had promised each other that they would protect Rowan as long as they lived. Holly didn't offer Jocelyn words of comfort. Perhaps because she knew Rowan too well. Like Holly, Melisande wasn't sure if Rowan would touch the crystals or not. Throughout Rowan's life, his gift had brought him to the brink of understanding time's force in the world, but the deepest answers had always eluded him. If those answers were waiting in the crystal cave, he might take the risk. Melisande understood the temptation. If she were Rowan, if she had lived his life, she might do the same. Her thoughts returned to the picture frame, and Jocelyn and Robert's last fight in Turkey. And she found herself agreeing with Robert West. Rowan had been put on this earth for a reason, and the Uparts had led him to Nika. Rowan's one mistake was that he hadn't taken her with him.
37. The Mine. Oscar Gonzalez hated his job. There was no escaping the heat in a sweltering control room 1,000 feet below ground, even in the antechamber with fans running at high speed. He had thought this oppressive sauna would at least help with his weight problem, but his girth had not shrunk in the 5 years he'd been operations manager at the Crystal Cave. Today he was in a terrible mood, partly due to the lunch his wife had packed him earlier, an apple, 3 celery sticks, and half of a tuna sandwich with a speck of mayonnaise. Now he was starving and ready for dinner, but had to stay after hours to give a tour to some wealthy tourists who were friends with the president. Of the company or of Mexico, at this point it could be either, because only a select number of scientists were allowed inside. The tall man in black and the little Asian woman were an odd pair. They were probably space engineers from NASA, the strange ones always were. The tall man's brother was running late and due to meet them any minute. Oscar finished shaking the man's hand and gave him a pained smile. "Why me?" Rowan pulled his hand away from Oscar's and put his glove back on, feeling satisfied. Oscar Gonzalez had no idea why they were there. The poor man just wanted to go home and have dinner. Oscar snapped his fingers and pointed at him, remembering.
"A woman named Holly something called. She said she was having trouble reaching you and for you to call her when you got here."
Rowan smiled and nodded. He had no intention of calling Holly. He didn't need the distraction. They were waiting outside the mine's main entrance for Stuart to arrive, and their tour guide was growing antsy. Oscar checked his watch and rubbed his hand across his face in frustration. They'd been waiting almost 30 minutes now. "He'll be here," Rowan insisted. He'd come too far to leave Stuart behind. This was Stuart's discovery, and he deserved to be in the cave as much as they did. Sun was staring off into the distance with her arms crossed.
"Here he comes."
From afar, they could see the car kicking up dust as the taxi made its way up the mountain. Rowan could make out Stuart sitting in the back seat, and a rush of relief hit him. After witnessing the attack at Stuart's house, he thought he'd never see him again. Who were the men who had taken him? And where were Miguel and Guillen? Oscar hurried to greet the taxi and help Stuart out of the car. Stuart had his right arm in a sling and looked like he hadn't showered or slept for days. His face was haggard, with deep circles under his eyes. Oscar herded Stuart toward the doors, anxious to begin.
"Good, good. Come, come. We've been waiting."
"Son?" Stuart stopped short when he saw her.
"How?"
"I found her through Hanush's key."
Rowan didn't have time to explain. Stuart looked at Rowan in amazement.
"Looks like you found a lot of things."
He motioned to the building. They had so much to talk about, but right now Oscar was hurrying them inside to sign in with the guard at the front desk.
"Have you heard from Miguel or Guillen?"
Sun asked, her face grave. A pained look came over Stuart, and he shook his head.
"It was only me in the warehouse. What's happened to Guillen?"
"He's missing too," she told him.
"My God."
Stuart couldn't have looked more taken aback.
"He left the ring behind," Rowan said. "It's what got us here."
There was so much Rowan needed to discuss, but they couldn't talk freely in front of Oscar, and right now they didn't have time. This hour was costing them $1 million, essentially $16,666 per minute. It was the most expensive block of time he'd ever purchased. Oscar led them into a conference room for their orientation, where he opened up a large wall closet and started handing out the safety gear.
"Without the proper suits, you would have only 10 minutes, 15 at most, in there. With the ice suits, you'll have 45.
The ice suits were really 2 vests, and a caving suit that went over both of the vests. The inner vest had hand-size ice packs sewn inside, and the outer vest protected the ice. They were also given respirators that blew frigid air, as well as protective boots, gloves, and a helmet with a headlamp. The getup looked close to what an astronaut might wear. Oscar struggled to put on his gear as well, the fabric of his suit straining against his middle. For now, Rowan kept his gloves on, though soon the time might come to take them off. He helped Stuart zip up his suit.
Did you bring the upots? Stuart asked him.
Rowan took out Hanush's key and Descartes' ring from his bag and handed them over. Stuart opened his satchel. Rowan froze when he saw Miguel's upart, the Chinese compass, the spoon and heavy